Hello again from Holden Village. Today is June 24th, the year 2000, and in the fireside room, Paul Olson will be presenting another one of his sessions in the series Great Stories We Need to Know. Racism. Who? Me? This is tape number OLP 2000-10. So let's join Paul now for that session.
Awesome. This is a session on great stories you ought to know, which means that they come from African-American literature experience, the African-American literature experience. And this one is entitled Racism. Who? Me? And I thought I'd start with these words, racism, bigotry, and break those down into attitudinal, institutional, historical, cultural, and just to say that those are kind of the semantics of racism that are used in sociology and linguistics, and I'm not going to do any of that. I'm going to bring to you literature, and I think that these words, and if your discussion goes there, we'll sure go there. But these words tell us something as we explore them about history, about our culture, about our society. But they don't tell us much, those words, about the spirit of the human condition. And racism has the power to marginalize, and to marginalize folks not only politically and socially, and as it has historically, but also to marginalize and to shape and define individual personalities. To Martin Luther King's language in his great letter from Birmingham Jail, that wonderful essay says, does it uplift personality? And the racist powers have the power, destroy personality, can destroy spirit. And I thought we'd talk about some of those things via the literature that I'll share with you, some great writings from some great writers. But in just today's, only, of course, we're behind at Holden Village, New York Times, I just want to read part of an article. After decades of paying higher premiums for life insurance than white customers, more than 2 million black customers and their 2 million black customers and their families nationwide are going to be compensated in a settlement reached yesterday with one of the nation's biggest insurers. The insurance company, American General, said that it was making restitution of $206 million, mainly to black customers and their heirs, who, until as recently as April 2000, paid as much as 33% more than white customers for small policies intended to cover burial expenses. And it goes on to the article. But in my use, anyway, of these two words, attitudinal and institutional, that's an example of institutional racism. My own experience with examples of institutional racism, and I apologize for some of you may have heard this story, but I'll make it very short, is that I was all done with a master's degree in American literature. An undergraduate in American, in English, where you had some American and some English literature. Then the master's degree in American literature. I also had a major undergraduate in history from three different institutions, Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, the University of Minnesota, and the master's degree from the University of Oregon. And I was single when I finished this master's degree, and I was going to start on the PhD. And I was staying with a black friend who was also working on his PhD in English off campus before the dormitories opened where the graduate students were housed at Oregon. And we were just talking about different books that we liked, and he said, well, how about that scene in Richard Wright in Native Son? And I said, who's Richard Wright? And my point in that illustration, and there it ends, is that through three institutions, no one had told me, here's your degree, but no one had told me that it's necessary or even important or even at all desirable or whatever description you want to give to those, the quality of those writers. You don't need to know those guys. So I knew, as we all now kind of joke about it, the white dead men. But I didn't know anything about black literature. That's a kind of institutional racism, too. And kind of the thesis of today, I would say, is we participate in the historical, and we're victimized by the historical forces of racism, whether we deliberately participate or not. We are victimized by, shaped by, all those isms that restrict and marginalize different kinds of people, whether we participate deliberately or not. And I think that one of the jobs, and now we look specifically at African-American literature, one of the jobs of these writers is to give us the vision to see how our participation has many times, we would hope, inadvertently taken place in our lives. I'll just run with that for a little while and stop as I go to ask you what your reactions are to some of these things. But I'm going to start with this wonderful little novel by Langston Hughes called Not Without Laughter. And the situation is this young woman who is 16 years old. I'm going to start before that. This young woman who's 16 years old, and I'm on the wrong page, goes to, she's black, and she goes to the movies with her class. Now, because she could sing and dance and was always amusing, many of the white girls in high school were her friends. But when the 3:30 bell rang and it was time to go home, Harriet, the black girl, Harriet knew their polite goodbye was really a kind way of saying, we really can't be seen on the streets with a colored girl. He uses the word colored girl. This was written in 1934. To loiter with these same young ladies had been all right during their grade school years when they were all younger. But now they had begun to feel the eyes of young white boys staring from the windows of pool halls or from the tennis courts near the park, so it was not proper to be seen with Harriet. But a very unexpected stab at the girl's pride had come only a few weeks ago when she had gone with her classmates on tickets issued by the school to see an educational film of the undersea world at the Palace Theater on Main Street. It was a special performance given for the students, and each class had had seats allotted to them beforehand, so Harriet sat with her class and had begun to enjoy immensely the strange wonders of the ocean depths when an usher touched her on the shoulder. The last three rows on the left are for colored, the girl in the uniform said. But I'm here with my class, Harriet stammered. We're all supposed to sit here. I can't help it, insisted the usher, pointing towards the rear of the theater while her voice carried everywhere. Them's the rules. No argument now. You'll have to move. So Harriet rose and stumbled up the dark aisle and out into the sunlight, her slender body hot with embarrassment and rage. The teacher saw her leave the theater without a word of protest, and none of her white classmates defended her for being black. They didn't care. All white people are alike, in school and out, Harriet said bitterly outside to herself. Where does that fit in this, in our semantics of attitudinal and institutional racism? Both places. And we're going to see right from go that how these overlap. And that's part of the power of this, that our attitudes are shaped by the institutions, and it works both ways. Our institutions shape the attitudes. Do you remember the line? It's an unfair question in some ways. The line that she gets from the usher that suggests this is institutional, it's not me. Them's the rules. It's not me. Them's the rules. I'm sorry, but her voice is a little louder. And let's talk just for a second. Does she, the usher, have any options at all?
Yeah, she does.
Sure she does. And what are they?
Well, she could just leave it there. She didn't have to enforce this minor rule.
Right. She doesn't have to enforce it. It's dark already. The movie's already started, for crying out loud. What's driven her to do this? We don't know. That's the end of the scene, and there's nothing leading up to it other than what I read to you. But we sure can speculate that way, that it's dark. It started. Why? What's in her attitude, both about colored people, but also about her job? Okay, good. Anything else? What are other options that she could have? Part of what I think writers do for us, all writers, now we're going to look especially, of course, at black writers, is give us a vision of other ways to live our life, of different kinds of values, of different foundations for how we think about the world. So, I can just ignore it. She's there. Oh, gee, I'm just going to stand here. Who's going to notice? My boss isn't going to care. Going to notice. And, okay. One option. Any others?
She could have backed down and left her there. I mean, her class already accepted her being there. So her class didn't mind her being there.
Yeah.
What she was really worried about was the fact that maybe her supervisor or maybe somebody else outside the class, when the lights came back on, we're going to be worried that we're going to criticize her and that she didn't do her job right.
Great. great point. So she didn't do her job right. So I have to do my job here. Very good. And take that even further, about this notion of my job. I give her another option for it.
She could have apologized and said, and been more quiet. And even if she felt that she had to do this, it was her job. So she could have acted like she felt bad about it. She could have actually felt bad about it and softened her voice and tried to say how sorry she was or something.
Sure.
Like that.
Some compassion in this whole thing.
Human being.
Yeah, very good. And she doesn't. Her voice was heard everywhere. And there's a scene, by the way, in a different part of this novel where her little brother, or I guess he's a nephew, goes to a carnival, and the guy says, and here's the language, and the usher said, not unkindly, this party's for white kids. And he sends the kid out.
I'm not so sure that I think, although I agree that she has the option to be compassionate, I don't really think that it's within her realm of possibility. I think that she has been brought up to have the attitude of superiority, and so it's almost as natural as breathing at this point to say them's the rules. And she has to, and she's behaving out of that assumption that she is superior. She may have even been angry.
I'm going to write your words down so that we come back to them. Or maybe not this one either. S-U-P-E-R. And natural, sorry for my writing, is breathing. And where does that whole, that it becomes so natural that we can't even imagine something else? Well, there's still some other options for her. Yes?
This was a class that was, where was the teacher? Was the teacher with them as a...
you have what you have in the story. Mm-hmm. So from what you heard in the story, what would your observation be that her options are?
I don't remember all that.
We don't know what teacher's done. The teacher was there, we heard that.
The whole situation should be reported to her teacher, and then the teacher should be reported to the principal, and a strong letter of disagreement should be sent.
In 1934, that wasn't
done. They all had the same attitude. Well, it
wouldn't hurt to... Okay, we've got be nice, go through the system, which you just suggested, ignore her. There's still something else. There's more than that, but go on, way in the back.
She could have protested.
Yeah. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to protest this whole idea. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. She could have given the teacher an all or nothing choice. So you can either move your entire class back or you can leave her there. And so that way she'd be there anyway.
That's a kind of protest, but a different kind than walking out on the job and saying, I'm not going to do this anymore. It's a great idea. And yet, go ahead.
Well, she just did not question the system at all. And it reminds me Nazi Germany or something like that, where obedience to the rules becomes what you do, and you don't question the morality of it.
Yeah.
She could have questioned the morality of what she was doing.
Anybody read Himmler's autobiography? K. Auschwitz, a scene by the SS. Himmler says, people have asked me, Commandant at Auschwitz. Hess, Rudolf Hess. So many people have asked me why we didn't assassinate Hitler, why we didn't disobey Himmler. And he said, I'm quoting him now, of all the thousands of SS officers I know, not one ever had it cross their mind. Mm-hmm. To question the system. That's what he says anyway, yeah.
I don't think that's the situation. I think it's more like the way the usher probably thinking was, no more than any of us would think it was wrong to, pick up a dog and move him where he wasn't supposed to be.
So
the dog's on the couch, you pick him up, you put him down there. We wouldn't think, I do this because I'm supposed to obey that kind of rule. We do it because, the dog should be there.
Yeah, right. So all of these things don't happen. Instead, I like Jan's, she just breathes. A writer will tell us, where's the vision? Where's the sense of awareness, the consciousness? We'll go on. Here's another example. And what we're after, and I think what the artists are after, is that, again, we're not doing a study in sociology and history. We're doing a study in personality. We're doing a study in the human condition. Was that a hand raise, or was that a stretch on the... Okay, that's knitted. Sandy is the main is the hero of this little book, and he's the guy that rises to consciousness throughout. And so when it refers to that, here it is. At school, Sandy passed all of his mid-year tests, and along with Sadie Butler, was advanced to the fifth grade. But the other colored child in the class, a little fat girl named Mary Jones, failed and had to stay behind. Mary's mother, a large sulfur-yellow woman who cooked at the Drummer's Hotel, came to the school and told the teacher, before all the children, just what she thought of her, to the teacher again, of her for letting Mary fail. And her thoughts were not very complimentary to the stiff, middle-aged white lady who taught the class. The question of color came up, too, during the discussion. "Look at my child sitting back there behind all the white ones," screamed the sulfur yellow woman. "And me paying as much taxes as anybody. You treat us colored folks like we ain't citizens. That's what you does." The argument had to be settled in the principal's office, where the teacher went with the enraged mother, while the white children giggled that a fat, yellow colored lady should come to school to quarrel about her daughter's not being promoted. But the colored children in the class couldn't laugh. It's pretty clear, isn't it? And what we're talking about is the personality. And so what do you sense from that? The kids don't laugh. The mother fights. They laugh. The white kids do laugh. We'll go on, and you'll get a... This will for sure make you think about... This is what I think. This is one of the greatest scenes in all of American literature. But I say that about 80 times every year. Like, the story here. This is the wonderful short story by Richard Wright, found in Uncle Tom's Children. This is in the bookstore, and you get a 20% discount if you buy it right now. If you're too late, I can't go buy it. The context here is these four young, innocent kids, they're about 12 and 13 years old, have decided to skip school because it's such a wonderful day. And the first 10 or so pages of the story make it clear to us, the readers, that these guys are innocent. They're talking about who farts the loudest and whose mother wears combat boots, and they are little kids doing what little kids do. Let's skip school, and then it's very hot, so they finally see this swimming hole with a sign on it that says, "No trespassing." And we're reminded that though they are innocent and they do this, the kind of slur language that kids do, we also heard them say, "Hey, I hear the train. It's bound for north. I know what that means." They're conscious of north, they're living in the south, in a way that an 11-year-old white kid wouldn't be. They are also conscious of what this no trespassing sign means. And I'd just kind of like to put that here, that draw that sign, that there it is, big and bold. And they see that, and that's what's there at the swimming hole. And I draw it on here just to suggest that this becomes a powerful symbol of where you can go and how, and I'll set that up for you too, how nature, what's natural for kids, that is to play in the sun, to roll in the grass, to tease each other, gets interrupted by something structured in the society, by something that represents a kind of institutional segregation here. That what does no trespassing mean? One kid says to the other, "I know what that means. That means no niggers and no dogs." And yet they go swimming anyway because they're kids, and because they are innocent, and because it's hot. And one of the wonderful kind of, let's talk like an English teacher for a second, one of the wonderful kind of setups for this is the setting that Wright gives us, and that is we have this natural scene, and just listen to it. They grew pensive. A black-winged butterfly hovered at the water's edge. A bee droned. From somewhere came the sweet scent of honeysuckles. Dimly, they could hear sparrows twittering in the woods. They rolled from side to side, letting sunshine dry their skins and warm their blood. They plucked blades of grass and chewed them. It's all natural, and these are kids. And then comes this, oh. They looked up, their lips parting. Oh. A white woman, poised on the edge of the opposite embankment, stood directly in front of them, her hat in her hand and her hair lit by the sun. "It's a woman," whispered Big Boy in an underbreath. Now these kids are black, and they're naked, and they're in her swimming hole. A white woman. A white woman. Let me pick it up on the mic here. They stared, their hands instinctively covering their groins. Then they scrambled to their feet. The white woman backed slowly out of sight. They stood for a moment, looking at one another. "Let's get out of here," Big Boy whispered. "Wait till she goes away. Let's run. They'll catch us here naked like this. Maybe there's a man with her. Come on, let's get our clothes," said Big Boy. They waited a moment longer, listening. "What the hell? I'm going to get my clothes," said Big Boy. Grabbing at short tufts of grass, he climbed the embankment. "Don't run out there now. Come on back, fool." Bobo hesitated. He looked at Big Boy and then back at Buck and Lester. "I'm going with Big Boy, too, and get my clothes," he said. "Don't run out there naked like that, fool. You don't know who's out there." Big Boy was climbing over the edge of the embankment. "Come on," he whispered. Bobo climbed after. 25 feet away, the woman stood. She had one hand over her mouth. Hanging by fingers, Buck and Lester peeped over the ledge. "Come on back. That woman's scared." Who are these kids? How old are they? 12. No. Little kids. That, you know, and she is scared. And they know she's scared. And what's the deal? Why?
Black.
They're black. She's white. She's a woman. They know, these innocent little kids, that this is already bad. Remember that natural scene, the bee drone, the bird's chitter? Oh, that breaks the silence and all of the magic of that kind of ideal romantic moment. Well, come on, let's get our clothes. He made a step. "Jim!" the woman screamed. Big Boy stopped and looked around. Her hands hung loosely at his sides. The woman, her eyes wide, her hand over her mouth, backed away to the tree where her clothes lay in a heap. Big Boy, come back and wait till she's gone. Bobo ran to Big Boy's side. "Let's go home. They'll catch us here," he urged. Big Boy's throat felt tight. "Lady, we just want to get our clothes," he said. Buck and Lester climbed the embankment and stood indecisively. Big Boy ran toward the tree. "Jim!" the woman screamed. "Jim! Jim!" Black and naked, Big Boy stopped 3 feet from her. "We just want to get our clothes," he said again, his words coming mechanically. He made a motion. "You go away! You go away! I tell you, you go away!" Big Boy stopped again, afraid. Bobo ran and snatched the clothes. Buck and Lester tried to grab theirs out of his hands. "You go away! You go away! You go away!" the woman screamed. "Let's go," said Bobo, running towards the woods. Crack! That's the sound of a rifle. Mm. Lester grunted, stiffened, and pitched forward. His forehead struck a toe of the woman's shoes. Bobo stopped, clutching the clothes. Buck whirled. Big Boy stared at Lester, his lips moving. "He's got a gun. He's got a gun," yelled Buck, running wildly. Crack! Buck stopped at the edge of the embankment. His head jerked backward. His body arched stiffly to one side. He toppled headlong, sending up a shower of bright spray to the sunlight. The creek bubbled. I'm gonna stop just for a second. What, you know what's happened? What do you make of that? They're swimming in the swimming hole.
Overreaction.
Overreaction. Unbelievable. Why? Is he crazy? Jim?
No.
What is he? He's not crazy.
Conditioned.
He's conditioned. To what?
Self-righteousness.
Oh, good word for it. Self-righteousness. What are these black kids doing? Or what could they be doing?
Just violated his woman.
They violated his woman.
And all black men want to rape a white
woman. Sure, black men. All this stuff of attitudinal racism is all back deep in his mind that makes he behaves out of that. There's that line of, is he participating in history, whether he deliberately, he's acting deliberately, but where does the motivation come for all of that?
What's he doing walking around with a gun in his hand?
Yeah, you ask that in America today? Come on.
What year was this prison?
This is 1929.
You can read the Seattle Times.
Are these kids in the South?
These kids are in the South.
Because there's a whole property thing in the South where you can shoot anybody that comes on your property. I'm from Arkansas. So.
Yeah, well, it's true in Iowa, too.
That's true.
I remember when a guy broke into somebody's house and the gun went off and he shot the guy that was trying to steal his property and it was okay. Because he was after his silverware. He may kill him, but he wasn't. He's defending his property. We won't go there. Okay.
Were these books published at that time, Paul?
Yeah, this was published in 1938.
Who published them? I mean, I'm surprised they got published.
Harper and Row. That's a good question. This is the first good thing that Wright wrote. He wrote a novel that's not very good called Law Today, just a year before this. Didn't make it, didn't hit it big. This did. This was a popular book. Eleanor Roosevelt read it and wrote a letter to Wright. Here's an interesting literary history. He got this letter from her, and it said, I'm paraphrasing, I was so moved that I just cried my way through the whole thing. And Wright's response to that in some nonfiction stuff was, and before he wrote his next book, which was in 1940, this is 38, 1940, which was Native Son, Wright said, the next book I write will be so hard and so deep, no one will have the consolation of tears. What do you think he meant? I'm not going to let you cry and feel good. Yeah. We want more than that. And so his next book, Native Son, has this black kid kill a very innocent, do-good kind of liberal young gal. He kills her by accident, cuts her up because he's so frightened and afraid of what's going to happen to him. He cuts her up in pieces, shoves her in a furnace, ends up killing more. I mean, it's an awful thing, and you do not like this Bigger Thomas guy. And then you think back to Wright, the next book I write will be so hard and so deep, no one will have the consolation of tears. And what we have to analyze as readers is what, as Bigger Thomas, that's the protagonist that kills this white woman, his defense attorney says, you created this monster. And then we look at all of the social complications and social environment that created a bigger that was so afraid to respond the way it did. Well, that's an aside, a little literary history that's always kind of fun, and that'll be on the quiz tomorrow. Okay, so he comes down there. Big Boy and Bobo backed away, their eyes fastened fearfully on a white man who was running toward them. He had a rifle and wore an army officer's uniform. He ran to the woman's side and grabbed her hand. Are you hurt? You hurt? She stared at him, did not answer. The man turned quickly. His face was red. He raised the rifle and pointed at Bobo. Bobo ran back, holding the clothes. Remember, they're 12. Holding the clothes in front of his chest. Don't shoot me, mister. Don't shoot me. Big Boy lunged for the rifle, grabbing the barrel. You black son of a bitch. Big Boy clung desperately. Let go, you black bastard. The barrel pointed skyward. Crack! The white man, taller and heavier, flung Big Boy to the ground. Bobo dropped the clothes, ran up, and jumped under the white man's back. You black sons of bitches! The white man released the rifle, jerked Bobo to the ground, and began to batter the naked boy with his fists. Then Big Boy swung, striking the man in the mouth with the barrel. His teeth caved in and he fell, dazed. Bobo was on his feet. Come on, Big Boy, let's go. Breathing hard, the white man got up and faced Big Boy. His lips were trembling, his neck and chin wet with blood. He spoke quietly. Give me that gun, boy. The scene doesn't end there, and you can get this book in the bookstore. What do you make of that? What are your feelings? Just my favorite line of teaching literature is literary criticism starts in the guts. And where are you right now? Give me that gun, boy.
Yeah, power and anger.
What was the first word?
Power.
Power. Anger. Yeah. And to think that. Your word earlier, the superiority, that I can just kill two of your friends, beat the hell out of the other one, and somehow, you heard how it happened, you get the advantage, and all I have to do is say, give me that gun, boy. I remember where I was the very first time I ever read this story, and I wrote in the margin, it's not in this copy, it's many times through, I wrote in the margin that day, to think that he would. And what there's an illustration of a powerful kind of attitudinal racism that has been, you know, they overlap. What institutions have given him the power to do that? The schools, the churches we know, the law, and we'll go on with some more. Here's what happens to that personality, and what happens to that personality, what happens to that whole family because of Big Boy's situation. I have to see my notes where I want to start this. Big Boy, he ends up shooting the white man, Jim Boy, and kills him. Well, he's really in trouble, as you can imagine. And he runs home to tell, where else do you go, right? I mean, when you're 12, you go home, he comes in the door. What's the matter, Big Boy? Mutely, he looked at her. Then he burst into tears. She came and felt the scratches on his face. What happened to you, Big Boy? Somebody been bothering you? They after me, Ma. They after me. Who? Big Boy, what's wrong with you? He killed Lester and Buck, he muttered simply. Killed? Yes'm. Lester and Buck? Yes'm, Mom. Powell killed. He shot him, Mom. Lord God in heaven, have mercy on us all. This is trouble, she moaned, wringing her hands. And I killed him, Ma. She stared, trying to understand. What happened, big boy? We tried to get our clothes from the tree. What tree? We was swimming, Ma, and the white woman. White woman? Yes'm, she was at the swimming hole. Lord have mercy, I knowed you boys was gonna keep on till you got into something like this. She ran into the hall. Lucy, ma'am, come here, ma'am. Come here, I say. What you want, Ma? I'm sewing. Child, will you come here like I asked you? Lucy came to the door holding an unfinished apron in her hands. When she saw Big Boy's face, she looked wildly at her mother. What's the matter, Ma? Where's Pa? He's out front, I reckon. Get him, quick. What's the matter, Ma? Go get your Pa, I say. Lucy ran out. The mother sank into a chair holding a dish rag. Suddenly she sat up. Big Boy, I thought you was at school. Big Boy looked at the floor. How come you didn't go to school? We went to the woods. She sighed. I done all I can for you, Big Boy. Only God can help you now. Ma, don't let him get me. Don't let him get me. His father came into the doorway. He stared at Big Boy, then at his wife. What's Big Boy in her now? He asked sternly. Saul. Big Boy's done gotten into a lot of trouble with the white folks. The old man's mouth dropped, and he looked from one to the other. Saul, we got to get him away from here. Open your mouth and talk. What you been doing? The old man gripped Big Boy's shoulders and peered at the scratches on his face. Me and Lester and Buck and Bobo was out on old man Harvey's place swimming. Saul, it's a white woman. What do your guts tell you there?
They know how much trouble they're in.
They know how much trouble they're in, and why are they in so much trouble?
White woman.
A white woman. What else has happened here?
They know about lynchings.
Sure, they know about, so they know well their history, and we're going to read a scene in a second about how well Big Boy knows his history, too, in ways that he's running from that history, he's aware. So, it's a white woman. What's the worst crime in this story so far? There are three people who are dead. That's not what she says. And what's her only hope?
Get him away.
We got to get him away, and they do. Big Boy leaves home is the title of the story. We send them off on a truck. To whom can they appeal?
God.
Only God can help you now. The justice system? The legal? Let's go to the sheriff. It's self-defense, man. Let's go.
Yeah, right.
1954, 30 years later, we remember Emmett Till.
Bye, baby.
Well,
the terrible thing for the parents, too, is that when the parents are stuck, I mean, here you got a 12-year-old kid who's done this.
Yeah.
You can't defend them. You're going to be incriminated yourself.
Yep.
I mean, the whole family could be victimized now.
And they are. Big Boy runs away and he has to wait, and the kids have been digging some what they call kilns, some caves in the side of the hill, and he hides in one of those, waiting for his uncle to pick him up the next morning. But while he hides, he hears the white people and the vigilante group is out trying to get the black kid that killed this white man. And he hears their talks, he watches them, they do catch Bobo, and they lynch him and they burn him at the stake, and he watches all of this. But he also hears that, yeah, we know it was a kid named Big Boy, they went to his house and they burned it down. Mom and Dad weren't in it, but they burned the house down. Here's an example. Well, Big Boy takes off for these kilns, again, as I said, to wait for for his uncle to pick him up the next day, then head north. He knows he's got to get out of there. He knows his history. He's not surprised when he hears about their house being burned down. He sure isn't going to be surprised when they catch Bobo and lynch him, and they hear all kinds of things, and it's part of the emotional drama and power of the story. Come on, pour on more fire, says one of the white guys. I'm going to get me a souvenir. We know what those are. I mean, they cut off fingers. They cut off whatever part of the body they want. Well, here's Big Boy. This again, he's 12 years old. He stopped at the foot of the hill trying to choose between two patches of black kilns, those holes, high above him. He went to the left, for there lay the ones he, Bobo, Lester, and Buck had dug only last week. He looked around again. The landscape was bare. He climbed the embankment and stood before a row of black pits sinking 4 and 5 feet deep into the earth. He went to the largest and peered in. He's 12. He stiffened when his ears caught the sound of a whirr. He ran back a few steps and poised on his toes, and 6 foot of snake slid out of the pit and went into coil. Big Boy looked around wildly for a stick. Now, what would be your first reaction? Forget that kiln. But he doesn't have any options. And it's the snake or his history and all that he knows. So Big Boy looked around wildly for a stick. He ran down the slope, peering into the grass. He stumbled over a tree limb. He picked it up and tested it by striking it against the ground. Warily, he crept back up the slope, his stick poised. When about 7 feet from the snake, he stopped and waved the stick. The coil grew tighter. The whir sounded louder, and a flat head reared to strike. He went to the right, and the flathead followed him, the blue-black tongue darting forth. He went to the left, and the flathead followed him there, too. He stopped, teeth clenched. He had to kill the snake, just had to kill him. This was the safest pit on the hillside. He waved the stick again, looking at the snakes before, thinking of a mob behind. The flathead reared higher. With stick over shoulder, he jumped in, swinging. The stick sang through the air, catching the snake on the side of the head, sweeping him out of coil. There was a brown, writhing mass, and then Big Boy was upon him, pounding blows home, one on top of the other. He fought viciously, his eyes red, his teeth bared in a snarl. He beat till the snake lay still, then he stomped it with his heel, grinding its head into the dirt. He stopped, limp, wet. The corners of his lips were white with spittle. He spat and shuddered. Cautiously, he went to the hole and peered. He longed for a match. He imagined whole nests of them in there waiting. He put the stick into the hole and waved it around. Stooping, he peered again. It must be all right, he thought. He looked over the hillside, his eyes coming back to the dead snake, and then he got to his knees and backed slowly into the hole. Personality. Wow. Here's a story. Here's a story from. I'm gonna skip this and go to this. I have a play, just a scene from a play with me. This is Lorraine Hansberry's *Raisin in the Sun*, and I need some readers. How many readers do I need? I need Ruth. Men can do women's, and women's can do men, and who cares? I need a Ruth. Ruth. Come on. Okay, there's a Ruth. I need a Walter. Anybody that likes to read, have fun. Okay, there's a Walter. I need a Benita. You're Benita. That's a sister. That's okay. I need Lindner. He's a white dude. Okay, wait a minute. Just hand that back. Okay, here's the setting. I'm going to go quickly into it. This is that wonderful play by Lorraine Hansberry. And you know what? I'm going to read something before that. This is what James Baldwin says. This is a wonderful book, too. To Be Young, Gifted, and Black. It's stuff by and about Lorraine Hansberry. And James Baldwin writes the introduction to it. You read his introduction, you will love Lorraine Hansberry herself as much as you love her work. But he says this little paragraph that relates to what we're going to do here. He talks about the first time he ever met her, but that was a real short time. We met really, however, in Philadelphia in 1959, when A Raisin in the Sun was at the beginning of its amazing career. Much has been written about this play. I personally feel that it will demand a far less guilty and constricted people than the present-day Americans to be able to assess it all, As an historical achievement, anyway, no one can gainsay its importance. What is relevant here is that I had never in my life seen so many black people in the theater. And the reason was that never before in the entire history of the American theater had so much of the truth of black people's lives been seen on the stage. Black people ignored the theater because the theater had always ignored them. So in that institutional racism context, we have this wonderful play. That's just a kind of a literary aside, literary history aside. The scene is this family, Walter, Benita, their brother and sister. Ruth is Walter's wife, and Lindner, who is also, you've got that part, who's got Lindner? You're also the man, he isn't named until he introduces himself. Mama has inherited $10,000, and they want to, it's a wonderful play, go read it. It's in the Augustana Library. I don't know if it's here or not. It is here in our library, too. So she decides to spend part of this $10,000 inheritance by buying a house out in Claiborne Park, which is all white. And the scene we're going to read now is Lindner, the man, comes to the family and tries to buy the house back. because he, and you'll hear it. So it starts right there, and I think our first speaker is the man. That's Linder, the white guy, and he's representing Claiborne Park. And here we have the stage direction. Beneatha goes to the door. He comes to them. They're in Southside Chicago. Beneatha goes to the door and opens it as Walter and Ruth go on with their clowning around. Beneatha is somewhat surprised to see a quiet-looking, middle-aged white man in a business suit holding his hat and a briefcase in his hand and consulting a small piece of paper.
How do you do, miss? I'm looking for Mrs. Lena Younger?
Oh, yes, that's my mother. Excuse me. Ruth, brother, somebody's here. Come in, please.
Thank you.
My mother isn't here just now. Is it business?
Yes, well, of a sort.
Let me see. I'm Mrs. Younger's son. I look after most of her business matters.
Well, my name is Carl Linder.
Walter Younger. This is my wife and my sister.
How do you do?
What can we do for you, Mr. Linder?
Well, I'm a representative of the Claiborne Park Improvement Association.
Why don't you set your things on the floor?
Oh, yes, thank you. And as I was saying, I am from the Claiborne Park Improvement Association, and we have had it brought to our attention at the last meeting that you people, or at least your mother, has bought a piece of residential property at 406 Claiborne Street.
That's right. Care for something to drink? Ruth, get Mr. Linder a beer.
No, really, I mean, thank you very much, but no thank you.
Some coffee?
Thank you, nothing at all. Well, I don't know how much you folks know about our organization. It is one of those community organizations set up to look after, things like block upkeep and special projects. And we also have what we call our New Neighbors Orientation Committee.
Yes, and what do they do?
Well, it's what you might call a sort of welcoming committee, I guess. I mean, I'm the chairman of the committee. Go around and see the new people who move into the neighborhood and sort of give them the lowdown on the way we do things out in Claiborne Park. And we also have the category of what the association calls special community problems.
Yes. And what are some of those?
Girl, let the man talk.
Thank you. I would sort of like to explain this thing in my own way. I mean, I want to explain to you in a certain way.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to try to get right to the point. I'm sure we'll all appreciate that in the long run.
Yes.
Be still now.
Well,
would you like another chair? You don't look comfortable.
No, thank you very much, please. Well, to get right to the point, I'm sure you people must be aware of some of the incidents which have happened in various parts of the city when colored people have moved into certain areas. Well, because we have what I think is going to be a unique type of organization in American community life. Not only do we deplore that kind of thing, but we are trying to do something about it. We feel that most of the trouble in this world, when you come right down to it, most of the trouble exists because people just don't sit down and talk to each other.
You can say that again, mister.
That we don't try hard enough in this world to understand the other fellow's problem, the other guy's point of view.
Now that's right.
Yes, that's the way we feel out in Claiborne Park. And that's why I was elected to come here this afternoon and talk to you people. Friendly like, you know, the way people should talk to each other and see if we couldn't find some way to work this thing out. As I say, the whole business is a matter of caring about the other fellow. Anybody can see that you're a nice family of folks, hardworking and honest, I'm sure. Today, everybody knows what it means to be on the outside of something. And of course, there's always somebody who is out to take advantage of people who don't always understand.
What do you mean?
Well, you see, our community is made up of people who have worked hard as the dickens for years to build up that little community. They're not rich and fancy people, just hard-working, honest people who really don't have much but those little homes and a dream of the kind kind of community they want to raise their children. Now, I don't say we are perfect and there's a lot wrong in some of the things they want, but you've got to admit that a man, right or wrong, has the right to want and have the neighborhood he lives in a certain kind of way. And at the moment, the overwhelming majority of our people out there feel that people get along better, take more of a common interest in the life of the community when they share a common background. I want you to believe me when I tell you that race prejudice simply doesn't enter into it. It is a matter of the people of Clyburn Park believing, rightly or wrongly, as I say, that for the happiness of all concerned, that our Negro families are happier when they live in their own communities.
This, friends, is the welcoming committee.
Is this what you came marching all the way over here to tell us?
Well, now we've been having a fine conversation. I feel pretty all the way through.
Go ahead, man.
You see, in the face of all things I have said, we are prepared to make your family a very generous offer.
30 pieces and not a coin less.
Yeah. Our association is prepared, through the collective effort of our people, to buy the house from you at a financial gain to your family.
Lord have mercy, ain't this the living God?
All right, you through?
And Walter throws him out. But that's not the end of the play, and it gets more comic. Great job, give him a hand. That's a good move. React to all the kinds of racism and bigotry that we see there. One of the things that I think most people use to distinguish the difference between racism and bigotry is that we individually can be bigots and we can write, you know, racial slurs on the wall, but racism implies power. The power to shape a curriculum that leaves out Richard Wright or any other black writer, that's racism, and there's power involved. And I think that's when you'll hear, if in discussions that black people might say, black people can't be racist. Well, they're right when it involves that kind of definition, and that's the way I think it's used. So in this context, what kind of bigotry and racism do you see, attitudinal? Never mind what the words are and the semantics of that, but what have you just seen in terms of how people respond and, well, what do you see?
They really try to fool themselves thinking they're not bad people for it.
Well,
it's a wonderful statement. Fool themselves. And therein lies the goal of a writer, I think, is let's share the vision. And do you see how you're fooling yourself? That's a great assessment. Anything else? You're good people. We're good people. We know.
Polite words.
Yeah. They're, of course, they're very polite. There are no racial slurs. Good.
Right along with fooling themselves is the impression they have that it's for their own good,
yeah.
For the Negro's own good.
Yeah. We're really doing this for you, aren't we? They're saying, yeah. Good. So look at the rationalizations that go on. Anything to protect, and what are they trying to preserve?
Safety of their community.
The safety of their community, and that's the right answer. And in the most general way?
Homogeneity.
Homogeneity, for sure.
Property values.
Property values.
Status
quo. I heard the status quo. We're not going to change. All the things you said are right, and then in the most general way, we're going to do whatever we can to preserve the status quo. And that seems to be where the radical voice of the poet, in this case the dramatist, comes and speaks loudly. The only way to change this kind of attitude and these kinds of institutions is to approach it with a radical voice, with radical action. Lorraine Hansberry herself says, the only way we can change the racial attitudes in America is we need to go to court, we need to write plays, we need to march in the streets, we need to take guns. She lists everything. And it's from this end to this end, in terms of radical behavior and radical responses, that can undo this institution that Lerone Bennett suggests, black sociologist at the University of Chicago. The social structure as it is cannot provide the answers to the problems that have been handed down through history. So in other words, there's a restructuring of that social structure, and we talked about that in a session last night, about what kinds of institutional changes have to occur before we can begin to solve some of these problems. Anybody else? Margaret, yes.
He also takes up so much space. I mean, he talked the entire time, and as soon as they tried to speak, he's like, well, now we're having a conversation, let me finish.
Yeah. That's very good. That's a great observation, and it's clearly conscious on the part of the artist here to create that. But this has been no conversation. Get him a beer. That's all Walter said. Yeah.
I was struck too by his use of the pronoun our, like our Negro families.
Yes.
As though he was speaking for them, and they're in the association, but it's also the language of ownership.
Yes. Yeah. Good.
Like they belong to us.
Yeah.
Our Negro families.
Yeah. That's right. And in Jan's word earlier, the incredible, I think if you asked black writers to summarize the foundation, the main precipitator of racism, it's the whites feel they're superior. And that goes down to, you can trace it through laws and all kinds of established laws, institutions throughout the country. Here is the preservation of the status quo in a wonderful little short scene.
What year was the Civil Rights Act, Paul?
The modern, 1965.
It was 65, because when you talk about social structure, I can remember, I think that most of us can remember Watts. Watts was the first time in my life when I realized that our social structure was going to get wrecked. That was very interesting, wasn't it? That was before 65, wasn't it?
The play.
Watts.
Oh, Watts. Yeah, Watts is.
Watts was 62.
63 or 4?
Yeah. But wasn't that the first time in all of our memories where this social structure that you've been talking about really got rattled?
Well, I would say the civil rights marches of the late 50s and that was before.
It's all part of that, the whole time.
But the idea that blacks were going to take some power here.
Yeah.
I mean, there was nothing they could do. The dead ran wild and the police didn't know what to do.
Yeah. And Newark, Chicago, Detroit.
It could happen anywhere.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, I think we realized our social structure is truly going to be threatened. You can march in Selma if you want to. When you start burning places down, and it can happen anywhere, and that really shook our foundations.
I watched one of those fires on the news with my mother, and she said, why are they burning their own homes? Well, they're not their own homes, and the social structure, as you say, is going down, and it's a tremendous radical step. here's how Wright addresses that with the black people in this story, the Fire and Cloud, are starving because the system, the food distribution system, is skewed, and black people can't get food. The black people are going to march. And the mayor, the white mayor of the town, says, we can't have this. It's going to upset the whole social structure. So he goes out to visit the pastor of the church, who's the leader of the black community. And the mayor goes out and tries to soft sweet talk him, but he brings along two thugs who aren't so gentle, and they use all kinds of racial slurs and so on. But you'll get the sense of, you'll hear the dynamic going on. Boy, can't you see we're all in the same boat? Asked Lowe. Well, drawled Taylor. Taylor is the black reverend, and he's going to disagree with him, but he can't really disagree with him. And there's an earlier scene where they offer him a cigar, and he says, thank you, and he puts it in his pocket. And the subtlety of the writer just says, of the scene, the white people just looked at each other. And I think it's because this black guy took this cigar and he said, I'm going to smoke it on my time. And they couldn't believe that they would give him a cigar and he wouldn't smoke it right now. They also come to his house, and they're all standing around talking, and the mayor says, sit down, Dan. Well, it's Dan's house. but there's this whole, you see it all, the historical, the cultural, the attitudinal racism, and the sense of power. Well, here they are. We're going to preserve this at all costs, and Taylor is a little afraid to disagree. So aren't we all in the same boat? We're all hungry. Well, drawled Taylor. Things will be straightened out soon, Dan, interjected the mayor soothingly. We'll see that nobody starves. I beg your pardon, sir, a man died just the other day from starvation. Mm-hmm. Taylor's voice died in his throat, and he looked at the floor. He knew he had said too much. I reckon that makes you out a liar, don't it? Bruden, the thug that's with him, with the mayor. Don't it? Bruden asked the mayor. Oh, no, sir, said Taylor eagerly. I ain't disputing nobody's word, sir. I just thought you hadn't heard about it. We know all about it, said Bruden, turning his head away and looking out the window as though he was through with the conversation, as though his mind was made up. What do you think they're going to... What do they think they're going to get by marching? Asked Lowe.
They think they're going to get some bread, said Taylor. And I won't give them a goddamn crumb, said Lowe. There was silence. Taylor looked again at the jutting angle of sunshine and heard the mayor's shoes shifting uneasily on the brown carpet. A match struck. He heard it drop with an angry hiss into the spittoon. I don't see why we can't get along, Dan, drawled the mayor. I'm willing to get along, Mr. Mayor, protested Taylor. Dan, here we all are, living in good old Dixie. There are 25,000 people in this town. 10,000 of those people are black, Dan. They're your people. Now, it's our job to keep order among the whites, and we would like to think of you as being a responsible man to keep order among the blacks. Let's get together, Dan. You know these people better than we do. We want to feel that we can depend on you. Why don't you look at this thing the right way? You know I'll never turn you down if you do the right thing. Mr. Mayor, as God's my judge, I'm doing right when I tell you my folks is hungry. You're not doing right when you act like a goddamn communist, said Lowell. I'm skipping some. You've got influence here, Dan. You can use it. Your Honor, they wouldn't be marching if they wasn't hungry. That's red talk, nigger, said Lowe, standing. That's all right, Lowe, said the mayor placatingly. I'm not going to sit here and let this goddamn nigger insult me to my face, said Lowe. Taylor stood up. I'm sorry, sir. You will be sorry when you find a goddamn rope around your neck. Now, now, said the mayor, laying his hand on Lowe's arm. He turned to Taylor. You don't mean you won't speak to him, do you, Dan? He always calls Reverend Taylor by his first name, of course. There ain't nothing more I can say to him, Mr. Mayor. You're doing the wrong thing, Dan. I'm letting God be my judge, sir. If you don't do the right thing, we'll be your judges, said Lowe. I'm trusting God, sir. Well, goddammit, you better let him quick guide you right, said Bruton, jumping to his feet. But white folks, my folks can't plant nothing. It's against the law. They can't get no work. What are they going to do? We don't want no trouble. They don't want no trouble. You're heading for plenty right now, the mayor spoke, and his voice was low and resigned. I've done all I could, Dan. You wouldn't follow my advice, and now the rest is up to Mr. Lowe here and Chief Bruton. Listen to their language. That's part of this attitudinal and structures, the racism and structures of response. What kind of words did you hear? What's Dan supposed to be? How is he supposed to act? Remember that word?
The right way.
The right way. Mm-hmm. And we'll record him. He's got the right way. What else did you hear there? He's got to be responsible.
And talk to them.
What?
Talk to them.
He's going
to
talk.
That was interesting how the mayor seemed to relinquish all his authority or responsibility for the black community.
Yeah, yeah. And so that has another play on this whole word of responsible again, doesn't it? And what is it really to be responsible? Just in this scene. And you can take that in your own life. What?
Do what the white man tells you.
That's what they expect. That's exactly right. They say you're going to be responsible when you do, when you keep the status quo, when you preserve that, when you do the right thing. But the mayor, the Reverend Taylor, has a different idea about responsibility. What does he see? I'm going to, who's going to be, God's going to be his judge. He's got a different notion, and we don't know what that is yet. You do in the whole story, but he's got another fundamental on which he's going to base his actions. I'm sorry, I've talked to him. I mean, he's really standing his ground, isn't he, here quite bravely, given the thugs that are in his room. He's saying, I've done all the talking I can. They're going to mark. I've done what I can. I'm going to let God be my judge. So what's his foundation for how he acts? Well, you already said it. It's God's going to be his judge. And what's the foundation that they want him to act upon?
We'll be your judge.
We'll be your judge, yeah. Responsibility, law and order, keep it all together.
It's almost funny that the mayor says, God damn it, as soon as he mentions it.
Yeah.
He's going to be the judge. In other words, God damn it, I'm going to tell you what God's going to say.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yep. And Wright and does that a lot in a lot of his writing, Richard Wright. That goddamn isn't used loosely and carelessly. Just as a matter of language, it's also a matter of connecting to the themes of what's going on.
That's a good point. But they also pull communism out of the bag.
Yeah. Sure.
I mean, I think our country has done that in a whole bunch of different arenas. when anybody threatens our status quo, they're communists.
Yep.
I've heard communists.
That was the relationship between South Africa and the United States government for decades. Anybody fighting for freedom in South Africa, the ANC, they're all communists.
And now it's terrorists.
Or terrorists, too.
Now it's terrorists.
Well, anyone who wants bread is a communist.
Is a communist.